Hello, everybody. How are you doing?
Doing very good.
So as you can see, Jim is not giving the talk tonight after all, because it only seemed fair that he who has given so many of the talks in my absence should be given a little rest.
And you're here.
And so I'm here so that I can pay forward his many kindnesses.
And we're always delighted to have you.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely delighted. An honor.
So with that, on that cheery note, we're going to be talking about the five paths and the ten bhumis tonight, which could be a little intimidating. Did anybody feel that way? So I decided that rather than go over in a very literal and somewhat academic way, it might make more sense to talk about what they're about and why they talk about it, and then have a discussion, a fairly long discussion relative to the size of the talk, because I know I talk too much usually, and this time I'm going to try not to do that. So basically, if you go back to the beginning, oh, by the way, did everybody notice in doing the supplication to the Kargyu gurus tonight how parallel the supplication is to the jewel ornament of liberation material? It's all right there. And in fact, it mentions the paths and the bhumis towards the end of the chant. So it's pretty much corresponding to where we are in this series of talks that we've been, and discussions that we've been following. So basically, both the chant and the jewel ornament of liberation are an outline of the Bodhisattva path. And it goes into great detail about various aspects of it. And Gampopa, you know, laid out the conditions for the enlightenment of a Bodhisattva and its basis in benefiting others in Buddha nature and in bodhicitta. And he covered a lot of topics, you know, the Buddha nature, relationship to a spiritual master and the master's instruction, the paramitas. We spent a lot of time on the paramitas, which are the perfected actions of a bodhisattva, and there were lots of other topics too. So now what he's doing is he's coming back around. I mean, he started out, you know, laying out these topics, but now he's saying, let's synthesize the whole thing into a system. And this is a very old system. He didn't come up with it. This has been around for a while by the time he writes. He treats the paths and the bhumis separately, but actually it's one system. And it's sort of like, the way I think of it is as a seamstress, we have, sometimes women's skirts have an underskirt and then a sheer overskirt. And, you know, together they sparkle and shine and interact and create beauty. So that's kind of a metaphor for the way that the paths and bhumis interact. And you can't, like, say one is more something than the other. They work together and are only useful in terms of each other. But this idea of this overview of the Bodhisattva path entirely is really what we want to emphasize tonight, because I think that's more useful than talking about all these details. Because as you know from reading the chapter, it's very detailed and there are a lot of lists and a lot of sort of accomplishments that are listed that might not be very meaningful to us. For instance, I don't know how many people here have ever tried to teach Indra or have any aspiration to do so. But that would probably have been very meaningful to somebody who lived in the 10th or 11th century or 12th century, who was trying to kind of coordinate between the original Hindu system, which has trickled around all over into the Himalayas, with what the Bodhisattva's intention is. But I think that even in all these descriptions that seem rather arcane, we can see a kind of gradual expansion of the desire to be of benefit and a larger and larger arena in which that benefit might occur. So Indra is just sort of stands in for the vastness of view that we're talking about. And at the same time, this is all very intimate. We're coming from where is our heart? You know, what is it we want to do with our lives? So even though it seems really abstract or too arcane or too foreign, I think that we can keep coming back to good heart. What else did I want to say about that? The other thing that I noticed was how he kept emphasizing how apparently endless the path is, and how, you know, we're just these modest aspirants in the beginning, and it could go on forever and ever with infinite kalpas, you know, and it's kind of like, oh man, this is going to take forever, and you could get discouraged, you know. But he also says you step on the path and you're guaranteed that enlightenment will ensue. So there's that kind of carrot and stick thing going. But one of the thoughts that I had was, well, we really actually have no idea where we are on the path. I certainly don't have any idea about where I am, you know, and are we keeping track? So we're going to come back to that. So we have here, I'm going to talk about the five paths a little more than about the 10 bhumis, because I don't really have anything to say about these very lofty states of being, other than that I don't think that I have accomplished them personally. So let's get that out of the way. So we have the five paths, which are both a summation and an overview of the bodhisattva path. And let's just all assume that we're at least on the path of accumulation. We can just sort of rest with that and feel good, because we have stepped on the path. We wouldn't be here otherwise. So I did some side research about the paths and the bhumis, partly courtesy of my wonderful husband, who helped me find some very helpful material from our teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who spoke quite a bit about it in that very personal way that he had of taking it and turning it from the abstract and general into the very specific relationship that we have with our meditation practice. So what he said was, well, first of all, the path of accumulation is we recognize we've got a problem. We want out of samsara. We want to be genuine human beings. We don't want to keep tripping over our own neurosis and our own mistaken views and so forth. We want something else, which is, of course, like totally dualistic on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's very good news, because it means our Buddha nature is kind of nudging us to wake up. So we see that clinging to the worldly life, shall we say, produces an enormous amount of suffering. And of course, we might have different interpretations of what worldly means. And I thought maybe we could kind of pipe up and say, well, what is the worldly life? What does that mean?
You're asking now?
Yeah.
Okay, folks. Let it rip. What is that worldly life?
What would that consist of? I mean, what does that mean to have a worldly life, or to be attached to worldly things or worldly view?
It's the world of the ego and its attachments. Mm.
The world of ego. I'm just going to repeat what you're saying so we can get on the recording. So
the world of ego?
What the word that popped up was, I guess, my pure example mind was hedonism.
Hedonism.
Things that were pleasure, things like attachment.
Yeah, attachment to really groovy pleasure. More than the average.
Maybe after a while it doesn't turn out to be groovy, but it seems like it's going to be.
Yeah, it seems like it should be a lot of fun.
I think it's thinking that the simple fact of being a human being doesn't seem like enough. So we're looking for something else.
Mm-hmm. So looking outside ourselves, because we find that there's not satisfaction as things are right now. I didn't say it as well as you did. But
I think there's also a searching for personal peace through affluence, through gaining substance.
Yes.
Kind.
Searching for personal peace through affluence.
Through affluence of various sorts, or some form of richness. Yeah. I might add something about, you know, it's not just the pleasurable things, but actually worldly view could include a lot of aggression, I think. Would you agree?
Yeah.
You know, we're all very aware of a particular presidential candidate who seems to take great pleasure in rousing the aggression of many.
Yeah. You know, for me, I think worldly, there's something about worldly could be seen as paying attention to the world, but worldly, I think, means how the world, you know, takes care of me rather than how I can take care of the world. So there's something about the selfishness, I think, approach, I think we've all been alluding to or saying.
Yeah.
At the time that that was written to, it was probably, you know, a bit different than being monastic. So there was a monastic situation and then people who were not monastic. So it was harder to be, to remove yourself from worldly things if you were not in monastic.
Right? Yeah, and I think that's a problem that we still face. That's one of the interesting things about our tradition, which is a householder tradition, and it is more of a challenge, way more of a challenge, on apparently, because there's so many more distractions and so forth. But the fact is that in the monastic tradition, there was a lot of challenge too, and continues to be. So I think that's very interesting that we could have worldly challenges within the monastic situation. But in the so-called worldly life, we could actually use that as path. So.
And who was the great king who became awakened from the teachings of the Buddha? Who?
Ashoka.
Ashoka?
Narendra Bodhi, wasn't it?
Great kings who managed their worldly affairs or had help with that. You know, they probably had many personal assistants and things like that. But they managed to practice, and see, they probably were able to go on retreats or have their meals cooked and things like that. But they, so they had a support system. But still, they had a vision. They could run the kingdom and participate in worldly affairs and manage them without being caught. So I think about that. How would I do that? How could I do that today?
Right. In fact, there were several. You know, there was Indra Bodhi, which I think might be is that another name for Ashoka, or is he different?
No.
Okay, there's two, and then there was Prince Shotoku Taishi, who was basically ran Japan, and who introduced Buddhism to Japan. So there's lots of examples of people using the world as a way to go beyond worldliness. So we're at the point of at least recognizing that the worldly life causes suffering. And so we begin to accumulate virtues. And virtues is one of those interesting terms. It sounds really goody-goody, but the original meaning is strengths. Virya is strength. So, and it was on manliness too, by the way, but I think that we can become more gender-free about strength than that. So what are the strengths? What are the strengths that would help us? And the first one is mindfulness. Our mindfulness practice actually gives us steadiness that we would otherwise lack. And abandonment of neurosis and seeking ground. You know, we begin to see through our meditation that we don't actually have to believe so firmly in our version of reality. And we don't actually have to find solidity and, you know, confirmation and security, that maybe those things are not so necessary. The other thing that he talked about was developing aspiration, so we have some idea of where we're going. Perseverance, we don't give up. Clarity, which is part of what happens when we meditate. We begin to see things more clearly and understand what to accept and what to reject. And then interest, which I also think of as appreciation. So those are all pretty traditional values that are embedded in the path of accumulation. And you can see them in the Four Noble Truths. You can see them especially in the Noble Eightfold Path. It's right there. And it's certainly there in the Shambhala teachings as well. So, interestingly, Trungpa Rinpoche added joining relative and ultimate truth to these. So we begin to see the difference between our relationships and how we cling and push and pull and so forth, and sort of an unconditional ground that underlies them. And I think this is a really interesting place for him to put that, because it starts right out. It's like he's putting us on the fast track from the beginning. And he's saying, we can actually access our Buddha nature from the get-go. We don't have to kind of wait around and hope for it to show up one day. It's already happening. He also said that we can see and accept the clutter of our minds and their relationship to our world, but we also can recognize ungraspability. We can't grasp on anything. So that's part of that unconditionality, is that whatever opinion we form, it's not gonna stick. It's not gonna hold the whole ball of wax. So then the second path, which you could also think of as a state of a practice maturing, is the path of application or unification. So in other words, we've accumulated a bunch of virtues, but they could be sort of scattered. So now in the path of application or unification, they're starting to make sense in our lives. They're starting to be something that takes root in our being. And Rinpoche talks about it as our minds and bodies start to synchronize, which used to seem very mysterious to us. Susan McConnell, a dear member of our Sangha, said, one day I woke up and realized, oh, my mind and body in the same place at the same time. Wow. She said, I always thought it was something really arcane. And I think we all do that to ourselves. We think there's something out there that's different and better than who and what we are. And then synchronizing mind and body is just the simple fact of being here, showing up for our lives. So the other thing that's associated with the path of application is that we really start to take the Four Noble Truths to heart. And does everybody know the Four Noble Truths? Can we sort of list them off to each other? What's the first one?
Suffering,
dukkha. And then what's the second one?
The cause,
which is what?
Grasping.
What else?
Desire.
Desire. Well, that's the same.
Yeah.
Passion, aggression, and ignorance. And especially ignorance, actually. It's the one that starts the ball rolling. Everything else kind of has a domino effect from that. And then the third one is the good news one.
Cessation.
Yes, it isn't permanent. Yay. And then what's the last one?
Do your homework.
somebody
mentioned that last week. I saw this, the Eightfold Path.
The Eightfold Path.
Which is meditating and studying and contemplating.
Yeah, a view and action.
Practice and action.
Yeah. So there's several different ways you can do that. Like maybe not working for an arms manufacturer. You know, that would be right livelihood. I mean, these things all matter. They all work together.
Unless you're a really good mole.
You're sabotaging it. So in traditional terms, it's interesting that this is where the bodhisattva to be, or the aspiring bodhisattva, begins to realize the significance and truth of emptiness, which is one of those great terms that we bandy about. So emptiness, what does that mean to you? Not the school book. What does that mean to say emptiness, realize emptiness?
The phrase that comes to mind for me is from the Sun Mahamudra, which is, I think it's always arranged but never complete, the mandala.
It's always complete but never arranged.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but it could be that way too.
Okay. It's complete, I'm just not noticing it. Always arranged, but never complete.
I think what the point is, it doesn't end. It's not like finished.
Right.
Yes.
It's not finished.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
It's up to us. I mean, if we want to see it out there as the mandala, which is always complete but never ending. But, you know, it could shift, right, easily. It's like...
Yeah.
We'll have to read that.
Especially after it makes up the two.
I think that's great, Lizzie. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you, Jim.
I was appreciate her saying that. Because I think about
so
it.
So always complete but never arranged, that's kind of like it's there, but you don't really notice it?
Well, yes. Yeah, so, sure.
It's beyond our concept.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So that's the emptiness part that you're...
Yeah.
You're heading towards.
Obviously,
I
did it backwards.
Yeah. I think I'm not sure. I'm having this working idea about emptiness that it's things I don't like. Things that I, patterns, habits, situations that occur, that arise, that I find myself in or doing. And I know they're not going to go anywhere. And I'm invested in them, but I know they're useless. And I don't like it. I don't like it that I keep running into this quote by Nyingma Rinpoche. It's something like there's when you know, you begin to know what your habits are. The suffering that you have from getting what your negative habits are, your not useful habits, and the pain of knowing what they are.
Hmm.
And somehow I think that's kind of, did I get it right?
Versus the pain of having the habits and not recognizing.
Yeah.
In other words, living in them, but not, one thing is recognizing, the other thing is not.
That's right.
One's painful, but you can work with it. And the other is painful, but you don't know.
You don't know. And then when you do see your habits, and you know that they're not useful, and I think there's a kind of emptiness there. And the way that I know it is because I don't like it.
I find that recognition tougher the older I suddenly feel. Mm. You know, you have less amount of time.
Everybody speak up so we can...
Less amount of time. Like, as I get older and watch people leaving ahead of me, it's like, only so much time to get this in this body.
Mm-hmm. The poignancy. So impermanence, poignancy, discomfort could all be part of the actual visceral experience of emptiness. What is emptiness empty of?
That's a trick question. Right?
No, not really.
Clinging, something to cling to.
Mm.
Permanence.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The knower.
Mm. Yeah, any permanent abiding knower. Yeah. You guys look very pensive over here.
I recently read a definition of it, but I can't remember it.
That's emptiness.
There you go.
Of all possibility, that we will not know it until we recognize it, and we have to interact with it in order to even see it anywhere and within ourselves. So it's form and formless at the same time.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Form and formless at the same time. Mark?
Isn't that an interactive ground of
all possibility, everything? So in a sense, we're enmeshed in it whether you realize it or not. We are it. As
mm-hmm.
well as whatever this is, which is
mm-hmm.
a denser form of
it. Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to equate experience with the theory and not feeling articulate about that. But emptiness seems like the logical outcome of really seeing interdependence. Because nothing exists outside of, since the great paradox that everything exists in relationship to everything else and is therefore empty of what's called own being.
Mm. Yeah, it's like it's this giant twirly space thing.
Yeah.
There's no ground to it, and yet it's happening at the same time. Well, I think that was pretty good, guys. So here we are, back to at least intellectually understanding emptiness. We're actually abandoning non-virtue. First we figured out what it was. Now we're actually, as you said, recognizing that as uncomfortable as it is, it's more virtuous and more strong and more capable to actually abandon the things that are not true and not working. So again, we have these powers that the Gampopa talks about, of faith, perseverance, mindfulness, concentration or nowness, and wisdom awareness, which I assume is awareness of non-ego. So all those things are actually, we're aware of them, they're happening. I mean, this is really powerful. It's not like we have to wait around for eons to recognize these things. These are actually what's happening in our meditation, and we're recognizing them. And then from those powers, those capacities, you could say, within us, come the further virtues of faith, perseverance, mindfulness, etc. So then the third path is that of insight, which is where we actually, and this is familiar in a way, even though it sounds like, oh, you know, in a few eons we'll get around to it. It's also familiar to us. Calm abiding. We've all had those moments. They're a natural part of our being. And they allow us to realize the Four Noble Truths ever more deeply. And again, we begin to see in these paths this emphasis on the paramitas and their particular qualities. And it's spoken of less in the five paths than it is in the ten bhumis, but it's implicit because they're constantly linked and interactive in the same way that those two layers of fabric shift and glint off of each other. They're present no matter what our practices might be. You know, we might be doing sadhana of Mahamudra, we might be doing the Shambhala sadhana, we might be doing Shamatha Vipassana, but they're presence of the paramitas and of these insights is sparkling along with them, whatever the actual practice is. So Gampopa particularly mentions patience and emptiness as the two things that we really begin to understand and feel. And if you remember what we talked about when we talked about patience, it was the antidote to anger and aggression. So clearly we're beginning to calm our minds. Our minds are beginning to naturally settle down and be more reasonable and less prone to leaping onto causes and shaking them like we're an angry dog with a bone we don't want to share or something. In the path of meditation, which is the fourth one, the Gampopa actually talks a lot about these various worldly absorptions. If you read the biography of the Buddha, he actually was taught all these different meditations that lead to various dhyana states, various states of meditation, of absorption, where you're basically blissed out. Sounds good, right? Wouldn't we like to do that? And he found them all wanting, because they were not a permanent thing. And he was really looking for something that would settle the whole question. And he said, so, you know, you can do this. You could try all these states if you want, and, you know, practice great austerities and, you know, go off and be a hermit. You can do all those things. And you can experience all these states, and it might be even worth trying. Because what you'll find is you still have to come back to yourself, to your situation, your personal human dilemma. So just as an aside, Trungpa Rinpoche talked about absorption, i.e. samadhi, which is another term for it, and he said that samadhi is being fully absorbed in reality. So there's a whole flip on the situation. And this is actually what the Buddha did. When, you know, when he became enlightened and he was attacked by demon Mara, who said, "How dare you? You don't have the right. Who's your, you know, who's your witness to say you're the new enlightened one?" And the Buddha touched the earth. He said, "The earth is my witness." Well, the earth stands, you know, for the whole thing. You know, the earth, the air, the water, the trees and the greenery and so forth. So that's where our tradition lies, is within that understanding of not trying to get away, not trying to get out, but actually, in a sense, to get further in. Which is interesting because they're not worldly. This isn't a worldly absorption to be fully immersed in reality. I wonder, should we discuss that or should we just continue on? Anybody have some thoughts about that? The difference?
What did you say?
The difference between being absorbed in reality and being absorbed in a worldly sense.
Would you like to, do you think you would want to discuss?
Would you want to discuss that?
The difference?
It's up to the group. I'm not. I just wanted to remember what you said. The difference between the two.
Well, it's you know, I think it is what we're working with here, if I may say, is, you know, we're a group that we're working with mind, or whatever mind might be, and there are many different labels or kinds of ways to conceptualize mind. But it's very subtle. You know, what we're working with is extremely subtle, and hardly anybody who hasn't been immersed in this atmosphere and put some time into it like yourself, you know, would really have a sense of what that any of this could mean, you know. But you all have been doing it for a while, and there's a sense that you are, you know, forging ahead. You're explorers. We're all doing this together, and it's really, in a way, could be scary. You know, it's very bright, or it's unknown.
Sharp.
It's very powerful.
Raw.
Yeah.
I think there is a also a worldly, planetary, global awareness that's awakened. You hear that song, "We are the world, we are the children," the idea that there is no separation, as Mark said, there's an inseparability of all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than saying, this came here, that came, and we're going to be, the thinking is so globalized now, mind is so encompassing, that you can't get away from yourself. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
And television makes it much more apparent.
Yeah. I think the other thing that television points out, interestingly, is this dichotomy that's implicit in world, in immersion in reality and worldliness. I think that worldliness seeks self-reference, seeks some kind of self-confirmation. But we are nonetheless immersed in the very sharp edges of the world if we're going to actually be bodhisattvas. If we're actually going to do that, it means there will be discomfort, there is pain, and we're welcoming and rejoicing, in one sense, in the fact that we're not shying away, we're not flinching from that reality.
And I think, you know, if I just sort of repeat, maybe to a certain extent, what you were talking about, the connection with understanding this aspect of our experience called emptiness is crucial difference, you know, because we could be doing many countless other things.
And many of them very kind.
Very kind and extremely important and all very involving, but without some sense of emptiness that we're, you know, constantly exposing ourselves to with our practices, it's more of just ongoing repetitions. I mean, samsara has its attractions, but ultimately it's becomes repetitive and, you know, painful. So only, but I think this process is very humble in a certain way, just sitting here sometimes for an hour and just breathing and being, you know, we actually experience this view of emptiness on a personal level that actually unhooks us. This is, if you don't mind me throwing in my two cents,
getting
unhooked from that whole train.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the one thing that throws the what's it called, the stick in the spoke, as it were, of the turning, because it doesn't cooperate with our agenda, which is actually pretty self-perpetuating, and which could use everything. It could use spirituality, it could use meditation as further self-referencing, self-gating, create my own little gated, personal gated community out of spirituality. So recognizing emptiness constantly is what is the saving grace, actually, even though it's very uncomfortable.
And is it...
Or can be.
I want to say two things. I find it very helpful to look at the blue sky, to bring in the idea of emptiness and space. But how do emptiness and space go together? Like, are they kind of the same?
You mean physically space?
No, I mean in the teachings.
Do you guys want to pitch in here? I mean, I could rap on about it, but I think maybe it would be more helpful to have other people for their understanding.
Well, it's hard to say that because, you know, right now, not knowing what you mean by space. But space, you know what I'm saying? There's great space, and then we have an idea about that.
It's a place where all is possible, like where every possibility exists in a way, like knowing that. And it's just up to us whether we pick up this or this thread. Or
so you see this sort of like space. A big matrix of possibility.
Yeah, I guess so. Enters net, whichever pieces, whichever jewels we piece together or not. That idea of Indra's net, that we're all caught in that samsara. But anyways, no space, I just see both those concepts of space and emptiness when you're caught up in your thoughts, both very helpful.
Yeah, I can see some differences between the two.
Well, yeah. Then
that was your question.
Right? I guess so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, emptiness is the experience of nothing to cling to. That my whole scenario is collapsing all the time. And space seems to be the accommodation for that process to occur.
So the way they relate to each other very closely.
Well, very much so, yeah.
Emptiness exists within space, sort of.
Well, our experience of emptiness. I think that when the Buddhists talk about emptiness, they're not talking about some place that's empty.
No.
I think it's a very specific and direct experience of reality that's inclusive and penetrating.
Things not existing.
Well, as such, per se, as Rinpoche used to say.
What's that?
He used to say, we don't exist as such, per se. And then he would laugh. Put them together, it's sort of good, you know, it's like you have both aspects, building and deconstructing.
Right.
Yeah.
Lego reality.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I can just, sort of, the thing about space, am I taking too much time here?
No, let's see, it's 8,
Okay, that was right, because I think you've got things going.
Well, we'll just go on briefly here. What else have I got here to tell you? So we have these, meditation could include the worldly absorption states, but also meditation purifies. I think this is a really important point. And what's meant by purifies, I think, relates directly to what are called Digpa and Dripa. And Digpa is confused. I may get these backwards because I'm really good at that. Is confused, fixated ideas about reality. And Dripa is neurosis. I always think of it as Dripa because it's dripping, you know, like bleh. You know. So, afflicted emotions, that's what it's also called. Not just afflictive, but afflicted. You know, because we could actually experience something quite pure and perfect about an emotion, but generally it's so cluttered up with our clinging to it or our aversion to it or our interpretation of it. So what we're doing is when we're purifying these two, we're letting go, letting go, letting go. Whoa, there we go, see?
What timing? The lights just went out.
Yeah, how about that?
Very interesting.
It's kind of beautiful.
The audience who's not here right now, let it go when the lights go out.
Yeah, really, it's perfect.
Oh, those are, yeah. The battery came on, yeah.
Yeah. So it may come back on or not, but let's just get through these next few things that are associated with the path of meditation. One is, interestingly, the four immeasurables, which briefly may all beings enjoy happiness and the root of happiness, be free from suffering and the root of suffering, not be separated from the great happiness devoid of suffering, and dwell in the great equanimity free from passion, aggression, and prejudice or ignorance. So, in a sense, these are worldly because we're, you know, we could very conventionally want that for everybody, and it sounds good, we'd like to be happy, but there's also a more profound meaning to it, which is that they somehow or other, through all these kalpas, all these eons, it is possible for an amoeba and a worm and a bird and a marmot and a dog and a cat and a human being and a prince and a god to experience their true nature, which is quite wonderful, you know, and which is very much beyond the worldly view. So, obviously, a worm would have a different personal view of what happiness is while it's a worm, but it doesn't get stuck. And as the path of insight, the Eightfold Path is not just practiced, but perfected. And then the last of the five, oh, sorry, the fourth of the five is the perfection of no more, oh, sorry, it is the fifth, the perfection of no more learning, which is full realization, which is also known as full purification. So in a sense, what we're doing is we're getting rid of all the obstructions, all the obstacles to what we already are, who we already are. So we're not adding on to, we're actually sort of like relaxing, not being attached to the things that are actually problematic, which doesn't mean trying to fix ourselves. It means stopping trying to fix ourselves. So, in the path of perfection, this happens through what's called the Vajra-like absorption, where we realize the nature of awareness, the exhaustion of causes, we're not creating karma anymore, and the unborn or non-production of further karma. So we're not only through the Eightfold Path stopped doing the nutty things that we've done, but we actually understand all the way through and through how unnecessary it is, and we stop. We just don't have to do it anymore, and we don't. So we're not creating further karma. And I looked up Vajra-like, which he lists there, the Gampopa, unobstructed, indestructible, stable, one taste, and all pervasive. These also relate very much to Mahamudra's practice and understanding. So we don't have time to go through that, but there's a wonderful book that I highly recommend called Lamp of Mahamudra, that if you're interested in pursuing more on your own, I can't recommend it more highly. And there's another one, The Crystal Cave. Is that available generally?
Yeah, it's pretty hard to get.
Yes,
yeah, bad print. Who wrote Lamb of Mahmoudra, do you know?
It was one of the Karmapas, I think. Yeah. So now we're to the Boomies at 8:45. Sorry.
I just want to mention about the purification.
Yes.
Basically, you know, they've been testing now, they being scientists, quote, have been testing llamas.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a technique to cleanse the brain.
Mm-hmm.
That the Tibetans have known all this time.
Mm-hmm.
And that scientists are seeing, yeah, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all these interesting wavelengths that are really good for the body and the spirit.
Yeah, yeah. I think that the kind of the learning curve for scientists is the spiritual aspect of that, which has been, it's coming. Mm. It's coming along. But there was this idea that you could just sort of get rid of the spiritual aspect and just get to the goody, and it turns out that didn't work. It turns out there has to be some vaster view and some deeper understanding in that. So it's not just about sort of rewiring our bodies. It's interesting to know.
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay, I'm going to rush through the Boomies, all 10 of them. First of all, Boomi means foundation, stage, or level of understanding. And each Boomi is the foundation for the next one and the basis for it. Just as in the Shambhala teachings, we have the four dignities of the tiger, lion, Garuda, and dragon, each of which represent a kind of a relationship to ourselves and the world. And I'm not going to go through all of that, but I think it's interesting to notice that they're not identical, but there are a lot of correspondences. And the thing is that we share the same mind. And there are all these different systems of interpreting how this process of spiritual growth occurs. And they all have value. But none of them is like the be-all and end-all. It's not like the Nicene Creed or something. You know, you have to believe this or else you're not going to get enlightened. It's more that if you discover that you actually are practicing patience or generosity, you notice that, well, yeah, it's true, generosity does feel very joyous. Wow, and they talk about that. Ah, I can understand, I see now. When I first heard about generosity, it sounded like the last thing I ever wanted to do. But actually, it feels pretty darn good. So we begin to actually identify with what we are taught. And the idea here, that Trungpa used to say that, you know, we talk about it in a sort of an abstract way without expecting anybody to get it. But it begins to sort of inhabit our being. And then things pop up as they become relevant. So one of the things that we know is that 11th century Tibet was quite a different world to ours. So a lot of what is talked about in the Boomies and in the Paz may seem very alien. But it doesn't mean that there isn't truth in it. And, you know, if we dig and we figure it out, we can see that, okay, teaching larger and larger circles of beings, benefiting larger and larger circles of beings is really valuable. And not because we want to have a big following or, become the next. Who was that one that Rinpoche hated so much? The semi-cosmic monster.
I can't think of his name. Either.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. He didn't hate him. Werner Erhard. He said, you know, he's a demagogue, is what he said. And, you know, we've got those every year, a new one. So this isn't what we're talking about. You know, benefiting others can be on a very subtle level. So each stage of the Boomies includes training, purification of mistaken view and neurosis, and therefore increasing wisdom. And that just runs all the way through as a theme. Each of these 10 Boomies emphasizes a particular paramita and perfects it. It's like we've been practicing them, it actually, we get it. We take it to heart, we live it. So these Boomies reflect that in their understanding. And so, you know, someday we wake up and we go, what was it Rinpoche once said? He said something like, well, my students have actually allowed me to perfect the paramita of patience. I'm so grateful to them. So, what I thought I would end with is a couple of questions. What is perfection? And how is it meaningful to our practice to follow any system? Well, let's start with the first one. What is perfection? What does that mean in this messy world?
I always think that perfection has to be applied within the context of a standard, or you don't know that you've reached it, because it will be forever. It will be eternal. The striving will be eternal. So if you think of, I think of the Olympics because I'm watching them, and if you get a 15.5, you've reached the perfection of that art that they're practicing. So because they've satisfied all elements of that standard, it is deemed perfect.
So how would that apply to our practice or to wisdom? I don't have an answer. I'm
those
just
who have gone before have established stages based on experiential reality that's been theirs and gone higher and higher and lighter and lighter. So they've provided a pathway, in a sense, an external standard to work against. You're not flying blind. There's actually something there you can not measure yourself against, but something you can sort of, because you can only measure it by your own experience, but at least it gives us a roadmap for attainment.
Yeah, I like that. The roadmap. Anybody else?
Well, the path is the goal. We need to remember that. Get disheartened.
Yeah, I think this is another really important part of that. The answer. Actually, you're both answering both questions, which is how is this relevant to our practice?
Maybe talking about the path, does the word perfection arise in the context of the Bodhisattva path and the paramitas?
Specifically that, yeah.
So it seems like one thought was that having this use of the term perfection keeps us out of nihilism. I'm not sure how it keeps about it, eternalism. Probably there's an explanation for that too, but nihilism and eternalism being two the ends of a duality, right? So that maybe if there wasn't a standard, some sort of standard that you're working with of the people who have gone before, that because of the misconception of the idea of emptiness and various things, that it would be easy to fall into becoming nihilistic, you know, and like being really negative in a certain way, in an arrogant way.
Yeah, I could see eternalism in there too, because you could also say, well, I'm going to aim for perfection.
Yeah.
And then I'll be saved.
So this perfection, somehow it's built in there. I know that you can't, you know, you don't get stuck there. Well, because of the understanding of realms.
Yeah, but I think the other thing that's helpful to remember is what does it mean in the original Sanskrit?
Yeah.
Which means para. I'm trying to formulate it. And immediately my mind went gone. Gone beyond.
Gone beyond ego. Can something be perfect in the moment and then the next moment it's imperfect? Isn't that what happens? It's,
yeah. Or we could be imperfect and yet be experiencing perfection. That's a really challenging one for us.
It's an ever-changing situation. So unless you reach enlightenment or be close, there's not going to be a lot of perfection. Or if there is, it's not going to be the next
Well, what about the great perfection, which is what Dzogchen is?
I think perfection is almost unattainable and a trap, because basically if you were perfect, you probably wouldn't realize it. So just even to talk about achieving perfection is cruel.
Yeah,
that's it. There is one of the things that the people in the Great Perfection talk about a lot is relaxation, which in that sense means not clinging. You're relaxing our tendency to cling, and so you can be, you know, so there's there's lots of words that have been used about it, a sense of completeness. So that there's no need to elaborate.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you can reach perfection. Otherwise, what's the point? You can. Because otherwise, you wouldn't go from one level to the other if you didn't do that.
Well, this is the next question that we have. So how does going from one level to another have value for us as practitioners? How does recognizing, is this the same as achieving a higher score?
Isn't it something about something doesn't arise again? Something doesn't, you've worked at it enough that situation doesn't arise again, or that problem, or whatever you want to call it.
So in other words, it's a kind of a resolution of previous difficulties.
Yeah. That not going down the road with the hole in it that you used to fall in.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
In the book Radius Concern, Trump Rinpoche talks about the big no, where he got extraordinarily annoyed and hit a table and broke it. You know, so we think, you know, we say, well, anger, you know, that's not good. But, you know, here's somebody who went from lots of other points of view, you would say he actually had, he lived the paramita.
So he probably made a point that
he hit a dent, at least.
Caught somebody's attention that needed it to be.
So I think that it's too easy for us to attach relative values to this. And in terms of, you know, I just keep finding that with all of the Buddha Dharma, you know, if it's talking about stuff that is inherent to being a human being, then I want to know what in my experience actually is in that direction. How do I recognize that so I can relax and not cling to my hope that things will be different, or my fear that things will be different?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is also about not clinging to my hope that I will achieve a certain level of realization.
Yeah.
Because I think that's very confusing. To put it mildly.
Yeah.
I just hope I can get to the center. I mean, you know what I mean?
To this center.
Small aspirations. Right.
Yeah.
Make it to sitting on time.
I was listening to one of Fleet Moll's talks, and he's a kind of coach. And he was talking about having this sense of mastery, being on the path of mastery in your life. You never, it's not like you're going to win, you know, the golf tournament. It's more just that you have, this is a motivator in how you live your life, that you're on this path of mastery. And you're never, and you start out saying, it's not that you're ever going to get there, but you're just going to keep going on. So I think it reminds me of the idea of the virtues in Buddhism, which are probably like the early Gampopa, right?
Oh, it's all through here.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that it's like developing a different agenda or way that you move your life. So you go from worldly to having this sense of mastery or perfection based on the paramitas and the paths and all that.
Yeah.
I guess that would be the most ideal thing for a non-monastic.
Yeah, I think that was his aspiration for us in writing this. I have one last question. And my sister actually said this to me because I was talking to her a little bit about this. She's not a Buddhist, although she's one of these people who naturally came to a sense of that the world is sacred and we treat it that way. And she just, it's like the way she lives. And she said, "Who cares?" And I said, that's exactly the question I want to ask everybody. Who is it who's caring?
Caring about our...
our path, our practice, our achievement, any of that. Who's doing the caring?
Another trick question.
It's like reading someone's birthday name. About all these wonderful things they've done. Well, really, who cares?
Say that again.
It's like looking at someone's resume of all these great things that they've done. But really, who cares? It's like it's really secondary, isn't it? Because it's about how we live our life each day and how we do things to make ourselves feel better, or how we conduct ourselves in a way that has a value towards the rest of the world. So it's not about someone putting a little gold star on the calendar at the end of the week, or saying, you made a really good boy, here's your 25 cents allowance.
The interesting thing about caring, though, is that when the Songkhyang talks about the Shambhala meditation, which I think most of you have received that practice, he starts out with feeling. And feeling in the fullest sense of the word, of how we feel, what's going on internally, what's going on where our body meets the world, how we feel about the world, what our emotional state is, all of this. That this ball of wax that looks sort of like a me, how it feels. And then he says, without that, we can't care. Feeling leads to caring. So clearly there's also something about not just who cares as in the indifferent sense of it, but also who's caring. So I'm going to want to leave you with that. We don't have to come up with an answer.
Our bodhicitta heart, right?
Our bodhicitta heart. Who cares? So that's sort of not like a nihilistic statement, but actually a constant, very personal question. Who and caring?
Wasn't that like the call of emptiness, kind of like the bellwether to who cares, to constantly call you to the highest that you can be so that you can gain the awareness once you let go of yourself, then the mind is awoken to itself in a sense. But we can't get there without a lot of caring and a lot of
wooing
and all sorts of stuff.
I think so, yeah.
This might be a good place to share a poem.
By all means.
As we're winding up here. One of my favorite poems, very brief, by a fellow named Antonio Machado, who was a school teacher, Spanish school teacher, I think. Have you heard it? And it says, I think it's germane to a lot of what we've been talking about. And he says, translated, of course, in English, between living and dreaming, there is a third thing, guess it.
That's the poem.
That's not. Who knows? Move in. Go into the question.
Into the question. That's it.
Yeah.
So I sort of want to leave you with that, and myself as well, obviously. Let's live in the question. that open question,
that's
which
that
is also
a statement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Learn to love the questions.
Learn to love the question.
Until they, it's like to the effect of someday unravel themselves into the answers.
Yeah, I really think that is the absolute best way to approach this material of the paths and the bhumis, rather than regard them as a ladder to climb or an achievement that we might someday meet, which we will. He says so. He says he guarantees it. But it might be in a few kalpas down the road, so let's relax about now and be here now with that sense of open question. I think that's a wonderful place to live from. And of course, without open heart, you couldn't even ask the question. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Rebecca. And now, you know, it's wonderful that you, I'm joking,
I'm
you're going to be away on
a little bit.
We all
now.
Wish you well.
Oh,
Rebecca's
going
to be away in England.